how do you help to shape the good story? So not only are you telling each other good stories as you're engaging with each other, but also they need to be captured in some way. Because as you're doing the work that you're doing, there needs to be something that reflects back to you the sum total of what you're doing. Otherwise, you think you're working alone, or you think what you're doing is so small and irrelevant. So the building of the media within that process is very important. And the connection of that media to other cans in other places is also very important. So you're always hearing not just about what you're doing, but what others are doing that is in similar conditions to you. In our case, with the alternative, you know, we're connecting people to cans in India, in Costa Rica, in Africa. And there's a sense of there being a cans movement in which people are finding relationship with each other. So it, on the one hand, it is a global phenomenon. And on the other hand, it's an intensely local phenomenon. And that, I think, is very enlivening for people, that they feel they're part of something that could possibly grow enough to begin to have power at the level that we're dreaming of.
That was the remarkable social psychotherapist, political theorist, community organizer, and author, Indra Agnan. She and I will be exploring the politics and power dynamics of waking up to the climate crisis, social breakdown, personal agency, and one another. I'm Terry Patton, and this is State of Emergence. Today, I'm really happy to be in conversation with my friend, Indra Agnan. For over 20 years, Indra has been writing, consulting, network building, and event organizing on the themes of future politics, conflict transformation, the role of the arts, and integral thinking. She is founder and co-initiator of the Alternative UK political platform, which publishes the Daily Alternative and convenes new system actors, and builds Cosmolocal Community Agency Network. Indra is concurrently a psychosocial therapist, a journalist, and an author. Through her work on international relations and soft power, she's consulted to the World Economic Forum, the Indian and Danish governments, NATO, the Scottish Executive, and the Institute of Contemporary Arts, among others. She is the co-lead in the social enterprise network Bounce Beyond, working to cohere the next global economy. And she has a new book just now being released from Perspectiva Press. It's titled The Politics of Waking Up, Power and Possibility in the Fractal Age. Welcome, Indra. I'm happy to be here with you now.
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm really happy to be here too.
Wonderful. Well, as we sink into this, I'm remembering how many times in the past, in our previous personal and public conversations, I felt that you were able to touch a certain raw nerve of possibility, where many people look at our ecological and social and political predicaments with increasing pessimism and sense of fatalism and impending doom. You've always noticed the potential for our agency, and you've been applying yourself and applying your influence, your soft power, which is one of the themes of your life's work, to the whole shooting match in very embodied and particular ways that feel like they're opening possibility. And you've always done that in a way that I think is different and nurturing. Whereas you've spoken quite a bit about how your perspective reflects your nature as a woman, and how there are tendencies of how men approach things that can create a certain kind of closure. And I think that analysis and abstraction from the thing itself is one of those masculine orientations. And engagement with and nurturance of the possibilities of relating is a more feminine expression. I think I've felt the strength of that in you since I very first encountered your words and work. And I'm having the sense that with the release of this book, there's some additional energy behind your manifestation of this. So I'm wondering how it feels from where you're sitting, what the possibilities feel like, how you're relating to the death and doom and difficulty that are also part of the picture. It's not as if the masculine modes don't, you know, lack all validity. And so that's a very big kind of opening and question. And I'd love to give you a chance to speak at enough length to really begin to lay out where you're at right now.
Yes, thank you. And it is a big question. And probably I should go back to the reason I wrote the book in the first place, which is similar to the reason that I founded the Alternative UK political platform. Probably the energy comes from the same place. In 2016, at the point in 2016 when we first thought about that we need a new response to the political situation that we're in, it was just before Brexit, and it was just, you know, in that same period where Trump had been elected. But the very day in which I know I made the decision that I had to do something different and commit my life to something different was the day that Joe Cox was murdered. I mean, and it was a very dramatic starting point, if you like, for, you know, after decades of looking at the big question of what is agency and where does our agency lie, I finally decided to spend, you know, most of the early part of this century working with political parties and working in a political think tank, and feeling that I wasn't getting to the place where I could feel building could begin, or the answers lay here, or transformation was possible. It was mostly a frustrating experience. Most of what I wanted to contribute to the political scene, if you like, I couldn't contribute. There was nowhere to offer, what I spent my life developing. And on this day, the day that Joe Cox was murdered, it was so clear to me that the political culture and structure that we had was so dysfunctional that it had led to these very false binary divisions that were pulling people apart. In the case of Brexit, even families were being pulled apart. You know, there was so much construction of divisive narrative, and finally it had led to this, you know, this relatively young MP being murdered, simply because she was championing the Remain cause, and this was a Leaver constituent, and he thought it was appropriate to murder her. In the months that followed, just a few really basic facts colored the way that I was moving, and one of them was that only 2% of people are members of political parties, and therefore the whole political discourse was coming out of a very small amount of people, and that's what the media was feeding on. And the whole, if you like, you know, political field was dysfunctional in the same way as this 2% was. And when you really see that clearly, when you realize that the story of our power that is being shared, you know, by everyone, is very poorly sourced, actually. And you make a commitment to stand outside of that narrative and go in the search of something else. Then it's a bit like tasting something for the first time and quite liking the taste of it. And then you decide you're going to spend, you know, more time in that place. And the more time you spend, the more you immerse yourself in it and greedily, if you like, explore all the possibilities that you're now, you know, you suddenly realize, wow, so much is going on outside of this 2%. My understanding of what people are is so different from what I'm, you know, asked to accept, you know. The energy is different. The qualities are different. You know, it was literally like getting into a different, you know, swimming pool or a different bath or something like that, saying, I'm staying here. I'm going to go here. And that ultimately is where this very different, you know, life appeared for me. It was literally a different life on offer. And since I've been doing this work and we've been publishing The Daily Alternative, I've slowly, increasingly begun to see life in a different way. And I see our perspective, I see our predicament in a new way. It's no longer us against the problem. It's now, you know, the race to build, you know, the commitment to, you know, to forge. It's proactive. I've become pronoid, not paranoid. You know, it's just shifted everything. You know, I really try to invite people into that space with us, because once you're here, you see things. You see, first of all, you see so many examples and so much occurring. But when you're in a position like we are to join the dots between these things, it's like it is like waking up, and I'm still waking up. You know, it's not that I woke and now I'm woke. It isn't that. It's an accelerated waking upness where, you know, even yesterday, I was thinking, wow, I'm just not looking at this the right way. You know, again, you know, I can let another thing go and let this new come through more and more. So, yeah.
You know, I have spent most of my adult life as a spiritual practitioner, and there are versions of waking up. You know, there are different awakenings championed and celebrated and catalyzed by different spiritual schools. For me, what has felt truest and most central to my own life journey has been a kind of waking up out of I'm a separate person in a situation that has all kinds of limits that pertain to it, and how am I going to work with that, to a kind of ecstatic apprehension of the divine nature of the present moment, which is so full of wonder and beauty and endless creativity and potential and grace, that the fact that, you know, the consciousness is localized in this particular body mind that is mortal, and I won't be here forever, and, you know, I have now some health challenges that are particularly acute and, you know, possibly terminal. I'm now held to that standard with a kind of fierceness. It's as if the Zen master with his stick is standing right over me, totally focused, because anytime I go into that more conventional separated consciousness, there's a kind of drop into, you know, rather grim and unhappy, you know, kind of self-reinforcing downward spiral of energy. But there's a kind of waking up that's not subjective and personal, but mutual. And in the citizens agency networks and assemblies and different activities that you've engaged, you've begun to have a sense of this mutual waking up, which, you know, I would have conventionally thought that the richest kind of interpersonal waking up depended upon the individuals having their own awakening so that they were in touch with that infinite potential and that quality of grace. But our collective problems are such that we know we can't wait for people to engage years of meditation or whatever other methodologies might help them have those kinds of personal awakenings. And you've just never accepted that as a limitation. You're seeing a possibility that can originate in the interpersonal rather than in the personal. And yet the seriousness, the fact that, you know, millions of people have devoted their lives to that kind of subjective waking up. It's not an easy thing. It's not trivial. I don't think treat it in any way that is trivial. But you're seeing a different necessity and possibility, and you're focused in that. So tell me more about how that is.
Mm. Many things occur to me as you're talking, and I'm going to try to pick them out and string them together, and let's see if I get to answering your question. But it reminds me of the journey. You know, the original waking up for me was really when I was 11 years old and my brother died in a car crash. And I didn't know that he died. So I was told that a household asleep, you know, the phone call, my mother, you know, shouting, screaming, what's happened, and finding out that my brother had been in a car crash. And then a night of praying to God that he would survive, and finding out in the morning that he died quite early in the night. And the whole night praying was really my journey. And then, you know, giving up God at that point, you know, feeling betrayed, completely betrayed. And then a life, you know, a teenage life, let's say. My mother, she had 7 brothers and sisters, 6 of whom died when I was a teenager. So it was as if, you know, when you were saying that whatever life is trying to teach me, it's being relentless, you know. So all through my teenage life, watching my mother disappear, really completely not present anymore. My father, very misunderstood and frustrated, unable to help anybody. You know, this was my early, this is the foundation of my life. Right. And what I, if I can remember correctly, and whoever can, what you were really thinking when you were a child is that I fought back. You know, and what I was doing was making a new deal with reality. And I think I mentioned before that I made up my own religion, you know, and made up my own logic for everything. And I think what I was really at that point was dissociated. I think that as a psychotherapist now, I would say that I was in a dissociated state. And but in that state, I found my brother, and I found my aunt and the people that I'd lost, and, you know, created a new reality and or a different way of being alive. And then when I was in my early 20s, I met Buddhism, and Buddhism explained most of what I had constructed. It taught it back to me in so many different ways. And for a while, I rested. You know, for a while I rested and allowed myself to be taught and on the receiving end of other people's work, so to speak. And then moved into this social space where we would use our practice and our faith to build this global movement of culture, education, and peace. This was the movement that I was part of. But later on in life, and my mother became seriously ill, and eventually she died of emphysema. And I hit another point of needing to understand and needing to be able to make a difference. And it was at that point that I realized that what I had forged for myself was not that easy. I didn't really understand it well enough for myself. But it was almost a sort of creative, a belief in the creative that I was in fact the creator of my world. Somehow that's what I had done, and I didn't even really know that because I hadn't tested it. And one of the ways I tested it was in the last few months before my mother died. She was quite upset with me because I didn't spend enough time with her, and I had, you know, my reason was I'm so busy being a bodhisattva of the earth, you know, out there doing the social work with the people, and you know, and I was making excuses for why I didn't see enough of her, but because she was unhappy, and I decided to do a prolonged chanting session, 7 hours or something like that, just chanting about my mother. And in that process, I realized that I had taken on her story about my not loving her enough. And when I understood that I'd taken that story on, I could drop it. You know, it's like, because I did love her enough. And that power of understanding that I loved her enough was what I was looking for. And when I went to visit her again, everything was changed between us. You know, she no longer complain. She didn't have that complaint. She didn't have that anxiety around our relationship anymore. And it was at that moment that I realized that it was that in fact, even in relationship, there is something. There's no barrier. You don't have to wait for the other person to agree that everything is all right. That even in relationship, it can be your creation. It's a unilateral journey, even within a relationship. So I could heal my relationship with my mother, whether she did anything or not. And so I explored this a little bit more through my Buddhist practice, and I remember that there's a story within the Gosho, which are the letters of the Japanese priest that I study from, where he describes that everything is alive, everything, without exception. And so the question is, you know, you mean a stone? You mean a piece of wood one can imagine, but a stone? Or a piece of plastic. And that was the point where I realized it's alive because I am. I give it life. It changes through me. Therefore, it lives. And this sense of you as the... You confirm life by being alive. And you create life by being alive. And so it's not an agreement anymore between two people. And if I have that sensibility when I'm moving in communities or I'm moving with people that, I often emphasize how important it is not to be on the map, you know, not to be too... in the world of theory, but to really be on the territory. If you're trying to have a transformative politics or you're trying to be transformational, you have to be in the space where transformation is necessary. And what happens when I'm in a place or a community where people might never have heard of any of the things that I'm interested in, would never have heard of, you know, integral philosophy, or they've never heard of Buddhism, or they've never heard of, or they don't want to talk politics, they're just being themselves. That's where I get my most information about the quality of transformation. If I'm talking to somebody I haven't met before, or the kind of a person I wouldn't have heard from before, I don't know if I'm explaining this very well, but it's their quality that comes alive at that point. That is the aliveness. That is the transformation that I'm hearing. I don't know if that quite makes sense, but that's my experience of it. So it's not an agreement. There's no agreement between me and this other person that we should do this in order to transform. It's really in the relationship between, in meeting this person, that person is the substance of the transformation.
Okay, well, that sets a sense of possibility. And yet there are the very concrete and particular things that you've done in organizing community meetings that include artists and community, you know, municipal leaders, but, you know, just all kinds of different people in a way that is new and alive in some new ways. And that has felt fruitful. And then you've had that interrupted by the year of COVID, and your undeterred, even though the particular forms had to be interrupted, and you've watched what look, you know, from certain perspectives, like degeneration of some of the things that help humans cohere with one another in order to more intelligently address our shared challenges. So help make vivid for me, but also our listeners, how, you know, where does that point to, and how might others learn from what has shown itself to you and be able to walk a similar, you know, perhaps everybody's unique, but there are some features of what's opened up for you that a lot of people don't see. And I want to, I hope that listeners will see and feel and be able to actually engage a new sense of possibility from hearing from you. So please build the whole bridge if you can, so that people can walk across it.
Okay, so there's three things that we do at The Alternative, and each one of them, they interact, but each one of them is important in terms of bringing alive, if you like. And I think that that's ultimately what I'm describing is, you know, to engage at these different levels, which I'm going to explain. They're all quite different ways of engaging. The experience when you're doing that and immersed in that is to feel things coming alive. So probably the most obvious is, you know, is to witness how a current political narrative, if you like, has made us feel very divided. So, and with COVID even more so, we've got all sorts of new polarities, we have new camps, you know, new truths.
Right. New reasons to be angry at each other.
Yeah. And sometimes once we could never imagine to be the case. Mm. And with our nearest and dearest, it's almost as if the rift is going deeper and deeper. You know, in my own family, I have, you know, what might be labeled conspiracy theorists. You know, I'm battling, not battling, it's completely the wrong word. You know, I'm observing and listening every day. Mm. And I've actually understood so much better what that phenomenon is. And I appreciate it, in fact, now. Whereas, you know, I was being invited to ridicule it or to reject it. But if we think about everything as, you know, an act of deliberate divisiveness or disconnection, then, you know, remaining in connection, and I say remaining because in reality we are constantly in connection. You know, you can't really look outside of your window and not notice how much connectivity has had to be possible to, you know, to bring that car down the street or to have your rubbish collected or whatever. I mean, it's a miracle of organized connectedness. But let's say even so, we're living in the story of our disconnection. And so, you know, one of the most important things that we decided to do was to choose a town, you know, or choose two or three towns and do the patient work of trying to experience the moving into relationship of trust of people in that space. And we designed a process called a collaboratory, which starts with the very first process is, you know, is what we call deep hanging out. So going to a place, you know, meeting what we would call the usual suspects, meaning those working in civil society or community organizing or the people who are in the movements. These are what we call the usual suspects, all the good people in that place who are already intent on, you know, doing the good work. First to meet with them, but then to notice who's being left out of the conversation, who shares those values and those interests, but has never been able to get connected to that conversation, connect with, bring those people in, and then have an event. And the event was called a friendly, and it was, you know, we would literally invite people to dinner, a big dinner and with free drink, and then, you know, sort of play games. And there's nothing but an opportunity for people who haven't met each other before with these new constituencies, meeting, asking some big questions, but in a very light way, and getting them comfortable with each other, and then inviting them to the next stage of the process. So in the next stage of the process, we'd invite people, it's called the inquiry. We'd invite people to not talk about the problems, not talk about, you know, what is wrong or needs addressing, most of which we would think of as the responsibility of the local council or the government, you know, the official system that already exists, who's grappling with these problems. Instead of that, we invite those people to think about the future. You know, what kind of a future do you yearn for this place you're living in? And, you know, think freely. And we would always use arts people to facilitate these meetings to really generate as much imaginative possibility as possible. And so these people would then be bound by some sort of conversation. They begin to create more relationship through the conversation about the future that they all could imagine. And we would create the conditions in which they could even put them on the map, you know, like a big, huge floor map, that they could put these ideas on the map. And so begin to feel that they were living in a place that they had imagined together. You know, already having forgotten the differences between them in a sense. They were just now engaged forward thinking. And the third stage of that is what we describe as the beginnings of building the Citizens Action Network. You know, so this is an entrepreneurial phase, if you like, where people agree to make certain things a priority and start to work on them. The people from the usual suspects would be the people who could source funding for things. But everybody could have a place in this co-creative space. So what I'm describing there, a lot of people say, well, I'm familiar with that. That's called community organizing. But it's really to do with the emphasis that we're placing and the tools we were using for moving people into a different kind of relationship with each other. And the premium really was on trust building and, if you like, emerging a kind of love for each other. That was increased the more they worked on something together, the more that feeling would grow. And then finally, it's designed, it's called a CAN because it becomes a container for action, but also because in that, once it's constituted in some way, it can attract people who are not at all interested in this, right? So once you've got something that you can, talk about, and start to generate benefits from, for example, in this can in Stoke, we introduced a currency for any kind of activity that you're doing. You would be paid in this currency, and that was linked to excess product in the area. So then you could go to people not at all interested in the conversation, not interested in politics, not interested in community organizing, but you know, you could say you can get free seats on the bus, you know, you can get free cinema tickets, or you can have, you know, there's going to be free produce coming from this food project. And that would be your way, a new way of pulling people in that were not interested in the old ways. Eventually, you have this kind of burgeoning, if you like, new sense of identity and purpose growing in that community. But most of it is most of it was designed with a view to getting people's emotional needs met. So giving them belonging, giving them purpose, giving them some possibilities of achievement, you know, giving them autonomy, a sense of control, taking control back over your life. And that's really the design principle, if you like, of a CAM, that it should meet people's emotional needs. And that, to us, is the only proper answer or, you know, challenge to populism. So populism, you know, is where people, the way I would describe populism is where people can be emotionally vulnerable, but easy to trigger and easy to manipulate because there's nowhere for them to be moving into relationship with people on the ground. They're too vulnerable to the newspaper or to the radio or you know, to the call in the street. And something has to counteract that. So this building of CANs, and they're cosmo-local because it's technologically enabled. And so everything that people do these days at the local level is connected to the internet. So nothing is really local anymore. Everything is connected to global commons, global ideas, global practices and methods. You know, you can be in the global conversation all the time while you're doing something on the ground. Very important to this process is how do you help to shape the good story? So not only are you telling each other the, you know, good stories as you're engaging with each other, but also they need to be captured in some way. Because as you're doing the work that you're doing, there needs to be something that reflects back to you the sum total of what you're doing. Otherwise, you think you're working alone, or you think what you're doing is so small and irrelevant. So the building of the media within that process is very important, and the connection of that media to other CANs in other places is also very important. So you're always hearing not just about what you're doing, but about what others are doing that is in similar conditions to you. And in the case, in our case with the alternative, you know, we're connecting people to CANs in India, in Costa Rica, in Africa, you know, and there's a sense of there being a CANs movement, you know, so in which people are finding, you know, relationship with each other. So it, on the one hand, it is a global phenomenon, and on the other hand, it's an intensely local phenomenon. And that, I think, is very enlivening for people, that they feel they're part of something that is, that could possibly, you know, grow enough to begin to have power at the level that we, you know, we're dreaming of.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How does it interact with the narratives that lead people to despair that are so commonly promulgated and are, well, not just promulgated, they're the inevitable result of various perspectives that many people are taking. It's there in the media, but it's there in a lot of the data as well. I mean, my dear friend's partner is a nature sound recordist who just went on a field trip and discovered the dawn choruses are quieter and quieter. There aren't the same numbers of birds. You know, this is kind of new data from the field up to the minute, and it's it fits very neatly into this narrative of unraveling and demise. And there are people who aren't even thinking that fundamentally, who are just seeing the increasing irritability and anger and polarization that are happening in families and in the world as a whole, who come to the same kinds of pessimistic conclusions. And you're generating a sense of possibility in the midst of this, but it interacts with it. It can't just be an enclosed bubble completely separate. So how you know, there's a widely held analysis of the dynamics that it's so easy to destroy things or to tear things apart. It's hard to create, to build and create coherence and create a momentum of positive creativity. And, you know, that complaint kind of feeds into the negative as well. And yet you're really regenerating that again and again and again and again. Despite all the buts, you know, the yes, but rejoinders. So help me inside how that is working, not just in your own subjective experience, but in what you're observing in others, and how this is contagious and self-reinforcing, at least to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important question, and you know, I hesitate to answer too quickly, because it would be wrong to dismiss one narrative and replace it with another. And what I would say instead is that one of the things we can be grateful to social media for, or to even to Facebook for, is that we have learned to distrust narrative. You know, we've learned to look more carefully or look twice at what we're reading. Now, some people are it's the first time. Maybe these are the years when they're questioning things properly for the very first time. So you might say, with a conspiracy theorist, easily labeled, right? But if you look carefully, what's happening in that person is they are, for the first time, really questioning authority. They're really questioning, in some cases, their government, but otherwise, people in power. They may be questioning, I don't know, Bill Gates, you know, or you know, whoever is the figure in their mind that they think has the most power. They're beginning to attribute that person, you know, with all the power to manipulate their lives. Why? Because they're beginning to see that they are being manipulated. They've begun to question their own freedom for the first time. They're taking what is, you know, only 5 years ago, they might just have taken that as the new rule, you know, the new truth, the new thing to be obeyed. They're questioning that. And then they might just flip from believing that person, just investing all their belief in another person. But they're on a journey now of not just being in the grip of the establishment, which it was a very short time ago that we all were. And when people, for example, you probably know the documentary, The Social Dilemma. You know, when people, it's a documentary about Facebook, and it's like a big expose about how our data is being used, you know, and how Mark Zuckerberg, you know, capitalized on his early idealism and now sold us all down the river, you know, and Cambridge Analytica knows far too much about us, et cetera. And there's so much waking up going on around that, and there's so much talk about who's the devil in that piece. But the truth is that we've been living in that way all our lives. You know, we've never been free of propaganda. You know, we've always lived within the story that has been generated for us. You know, the Americans live in the American dream. You know, the Chinese live in the Chinese dream. You know, over here, the Brits, you know, have a dream of empire they've never been able to put away quite, you know, and we're all just playing a role in that and not even really questioning. And within that, there's been this political economic system that hasn't hesitated really to turn us into consumers, you know, to buy products to keep the economy going. and we've become slaves to the consumer economy. You know, all of our emotional drives have been completely hijacked by advertising to keep us on the hamster wheel. I mean, you know, once you really wake up to what happened to us as a human race, it's shocking. And for most people, this is a slow waking up process, and we're in the middle of it. So this is me taking a step back and going a long way around to answering the question about, you know, how do people cope with the truth about the environmental crisis? And I'm not a person who questions this truth. I'm with the scientists. I believe that we're in this state, and that it's a crucial 10 years for being able to turn the corner, and it's on the books, highly unlikely that we can do that. I think, you know, I'm deeply moved by Greta Thunberg and her ability to say that it is. However, number one, I can look at that as a narrative as well. I can look at it as a story of my life at this point. You know, this is the story that I'm telling myself. This is the life that I think I'm in. And to some extent, I can challenge that as well. You know, and then when I challenge that, it's the same. I would say it's the same thing as me saying, my life is defined by death, but I'm fighting back on that. I'm going to look at it in a different way. I'm going to find my agency and work on it. And that is really an option for people. And when you start to take that on, then you begin to connect yourself with, you know, first of all, maybe, you know, draw down, you know, 200 best projects, you know, and you start to really get into the immense amount of work that is being done and question or start to think, is it possible that human ingenuity has got the capability and the capacity to pull us away from the brink, whether or not governments are capable of doing that. Maybe there's something well beyond the government that's capable of doing that. And then you think about Gaia itself, you know, and whether or not Gaia is more than capable of rescuing planet Earth. And many people believe that's true. The question really is, can human beings survive in that process? And that's a very different challenge. Then it becomes a challenge of whether or not we can harmonize ourselves better and give up things more. But it's not the same story as we need to stop this Ferrari going off the cliff, which seems like impossible to do. You know, it would be more of a story like, can we switch the engine off and, you know, hopefully run out of this poor energy before we get to the cliff. It's a very different process. And then if you watch things flowering, you know, if you're able to watch every day how nature itself dies a death every single winter and still comes back, you know, or if you watch a house plant, you know, I've got many of these in my own home, you know, that go well beyond, you know, they are dead, right? And still they manage to come back to life because you've stripped, not because you fed it with bio, you know, plant food, but because you stripped away all the dead stuff that was stopping the life come through. You know, if you talk to a horticulturist, my stepdaughter is one, she's teaching me that I'm responding to live things in the wrong way. I don't have to make them grow. I just have to stop killing them. So there's another story available. And some of it is human ingenuity, which includes technology. And some of it is simply letting go of the story of it's inevitable that death is the end and it's coming soon. So I know that, please tell me what you think about that, Terry, because I know it's a question that means a lot to you too.
You know, for listeners who aren't aware, although I think many are, I had a sudden hospitalization and discovery that I have pretty advanced cancer that seems, according to the oncologist, to be very rare and hard to treat, and probably don't have it much more time. And that has been a it's taken me through a lot of interior territory in which the wonder and beauty of the life that I've already led and my gratitude for what already is have really come to the fore as primary. And but you know, as I've continued, you know, this acceptance, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. I want to surrender fully into whatever lies beyond this life and trust that process, not to waste a minute being in resistance to what is. But then, of course, you know, I've had these very poignant conversations with dear friends and especially with my son. You know, well, it's great that you're accepting if it's your time, you're willing to go, but how about affirming that maybe you don't have to? Huh? You know, like we want you to stick around here. We feel like we need you here. And that's been an interesting interplay because, of course, there's this paradigm that medicine is founded on, the scientific, materialistic, positivistic kind of view of things, in which the odds seem very low of all of that happening. And the most important things to do are just buy a little time with chemotherapy and, you know, the other things that might be a little bit possible. But of course, there's this other paradigm, which we know has validity. We do know, even based on our science, that we live in a quantum rather than a Newtonian universe, and that many, many things are adequately explained by the mechanistic Newtonian dynamics, but not everything. And that therefore, just as matter makes mind, mind makes matter, and that... So you have a lot of people who fasten on that, and sometimes in ways that are a little bit idealistic and naive, not in ways that really resonate for me, but it's kind of like believe in and visualize yourself in perfect health, and you know, but who does that other than the ego, right? I'm not sure that fully resonates for me. However, it makes total sense to my own being that there is something incomplete about the way that the situation, you know, am I a separate one in a situation that's difficult, and how much energy do I have this day, and what can I accomplish, and how much do I need to rest, and, you know, like situating myself entirely in that conditional perspective misses out on the radiant, transcendental miracle of this present moment, which is really so beautiful. And, you know, and even difficult moments are still alive with the vibrancy of you know, there's a yes in it all that is in its own way miraculous, and not just miraculous in its, you know, it has potentials that are unpredictable. This reality is full of grace. There are the potentials of miraculous healings or whatever. And the piece of the literature and you know, the create your own reality perspective that resonates for me is that to the degree that we keep reinforcing an unconscious belief in the mechanistic perspective, we lock it in and become subject to it in a way that's unnecessary. And to the degree that we wake up into the miraculous nature of the present moment again and again, we reprogram the subconscious to really not know. I don't know for sure how soon I'll die or whatever. You know, I that's not just active for me on a personal level, although of course it is. It relates to our collective mortality. It relates to the seeming inevitabilities. And this participation in a nonlinear, psychophysical, potentially miraculous, grace-filled reality is a waking up out of a bad dream that isn't even true. And that feels entirely healthy. It doesn't have me believing, trying to change my beliefs, kind of working to have a fastened down relationship to a positive story. It's a way just simply of freeing me of a negative story and putting me into feeling presence with something full of potential and aliveness and beauty and it stimulate a sense of wonder and gratitude and a clarity and expansion of awareness that's all lovely. And so as I hear you talking, I feel there's a pretty direct analogy between what it is that I'm learning in this personal way and what it is you're identifying as a different kind of politics, this politics of waking up. And so I'd like to invite you to reflect on that.
I mean, I just feel joyful when I hear you talk like that, because I think that's how I feel as well. You know, I feel as if it's the most incredible gift to notice that aliveness and you know, you said it so well, the yes. To notice the yes of life is such a gift, you know, and it's to share that with someone else. And I imagine you'll have a lot of that, you know, in this period of your life. It's to, you know, to be able to share that with someone else and to see that little thing shift, you know, where, you know, it's not that they have to anything, but it's just that they've noticed it now, you know, and it's like watching young children when they, you know, are looking at a butterfly, you know, fly, or they're seeing, you know, and you know, otters, you know, holding hands in the stream, or, you know, I mean, the little miracles of nature that children are so like delighted with, you know.
Yeah.
It's so easy to miss them. And yesterday I had had a conversation with somebody who, I won't mention her name because I have no idea whether she would appreciate that or not, but she was telling me that she's got a new interest in flowers, and that flowers are spiritual messengers. And, you know, I've always myself had a strange relationship with flowers where, you know, if I'm walking along in the street, I can hear a flower calling, you know, and I'll just go and stand in front of it and let it do whatever tell me whatever it's got to tell me. I mean, I know I'm weird when I do that. And I know, you know, even my partner says, oh, you know, interest off again, you know, but I can feel that flower giving me something and that of what I need right now. But after I spoke to my friend who told me a little bit about her studies and so on, and what she was learning from it and what the understood, you know, spiritual, you know, literature is about it. I went to this flower today again in a new way. I thought I was enhanced, you know, again.
Yeah.
And instead of just standing and listening to the flower, I felt myself becoming flower. Mm. You know, it's almost as if there was much more for this flower to give me than I'd ever noticed before, you know. And
it's like a deepened communion or deepened resonance.
A communion, yeah. Communion. That's what it was. That's exactly what it was. And for a day since that happened, you know, I've been walking around thinking, be rose, you know, rather than remembering that lovely rose. But like, be Rose, you know? And anyway, listen, you know, there's so much of that available to us. You know, once you notice that the world is really alive, and once you notice it's not only nature that's beautiful and alive, but people are beautiful and alive, and you start to listen to them in that way. So I was on a call yesterday, another one of these big Zoom calls, and it was about communities. It was a very unusual group of people called the Big Locals, and they had been granted. It was a crazy experiment that that the UK government did. It lasted for about 5 years, when a whole load of money that was from dormant bank accounts was given into one trust called the Local Trust. And that trust was then tasked with giving 150 communities, anybody could apply, got £1 million, right?
Wow.
To do whatever they liked with. There was no conditions, there was no plan needed. The only thing you had to guarantee was that you were, that you had a team of people willing to steward this money for the community. And it's been this five-year experiment, very, very interesting what's happened to the people. It's a bit, I don't think any of them did a universal basic income, for example, but most of them were funding very small micro projects and bringing these communities alive. And I was in the Zoom call yesterday with 15 of these people who'd been in this experiment. And it was this such a lively and warm and, you know, energetic call about what they'd been, how their lives had changed through this experience. And there was one person in particular who I was listening, she was more or less running the call, and she had such a strong accent, like a northern accent. It was so strong, I couldn't really hardly understand her. But everything she was saying was so musical, and she started talking about the meta conversation, and I realized that I hadn't expected to hear that from her at all. That she was talking in such a variety of ways, at so many different levels at once. Anyway, it's just a joy to listen to her. And that's what I mean. That's what I think is available to us, is the discovery that there's life everywhere, you know, that is creative and, you know, I don't use this word juicy very often, but it's full of juice, you know, and it's everywhere. If you can listen out for it and listen in that way, and it feeds you, you know, I came off that call and I thought, who needs me? You know, I don't know. I hardly know what I have to do. It's happening everywhere, you know, other than to draw attention to it.
You know, it's interesting as you're speaking, I find myself thinking of people I know, by reputation or by their books or other communications, who have been advocating for a simple positivity, kind of like, let's just change the subject from our collective situation and simply, you know, emphasize happiness or emphasize a sense of creating magic in the world. You know, some of it seems pretty ungrounded and, you know, kind of new age in the negative sense. And I'm reflecting here that they're onto something, and yet sometimes it, I think that at a first, if our ability to hold paradox is not really, really highly developed, we will tend to notice that there's something valid about that and then click into a totalizing narrative that just doesn't want to hear about the diminishing dawn chorus or the any of the other bad news. And it just sort of fixates on a positivity, almost holding it up like the crucifix and, you know, keep away the evil spirit. And I think it's ultimately rooted in a kind of fear. You know, it isn't really free. And I'm recognizing that what is coming into expression in our conversation right now has to do with an unreasonable happiness and positivity that is not fleeing the darkness at all, that is not trying to ward it off, that is, you know, one of the things that has come alive for me with this is, you know, maybe I won't live that long. Well, I'm going to enjoy the heck out of every moment of this beautiful life. You know, I'm not going into glum, grim, gosh, ain't it awful. You know, like that's giving up the time I have. Forget it. I'm not going there. So it's an attitude that's entirely positive. But it isn't, you know, I pay close attention and ask lots of questions when I talk to my oncologist. I'm paying attention to the problem, too. And as we should, as at a collective level, it's not a binary. It takes a very deep and rich and conscious feeling humanity to be present to so many different apparently contradictory implications of what is true at the same time. And I think that we are being asked, you know, like my book, A New Republic of the Heart, was in part a willing, unflinching look at things too terrible to face, especially at the time I wrote it, that more and more people are facing it. It's harder and harder to look away from. But that there's a medicine in that, that the darkness has something powerful in it. It's an initiator of a different level of consciousness. And that if we go into it together, something shifts in our access to one another. We become closer. We become capable of a different kind of we. The darkness is just half of the infinitely regressing polarities of this infinite aliveness of the present moment. And the positivity is equally true. And it is the fuel through which we are able to do whatever it is that we can do, or be whatever it is. It is not all doing. And commune at a whole different level. So that feels important. Somehow, you know, in the integral world that both of us have spent some time in, one of the important ideas is the idea that there's a pre-trans or pre-post fallacy that, oh, something is not rational, it must be pre-rational, or something is not rational, it must be post-rational. It goes beyond mere rationality. And so there's a binary thinking. It's either or, whereas there's a richness. I think that there's a pre-facing the darkness positivity, and there's a post-facing the darkness positivity of a whole different character that we're pointing to in this conversation. It feels, not just pointing to, participating in, and actually growing our capacity to more robustly participate in, and to participate in a way that is an invitation to others to more fully and consciously and feelingly participate. Yeah. Thank you. This is fun. I'm really appreciating this exploration.
Yeah. I mean, yes and yes to that. You know, I wonder if, I was going to say, I wonder if age has anything to do with it. But if age has something to do with it in my life and in your life, then that doesn't mean nobody younger than us. You know, if I see my son, sometimes I listen to what my son is capable of thinking and feeling and saying. I would say, you know, he can challenge me anytime. You know, so maybe it's my age, but not his age. Yeah. If you see what I mean. So maybe it's the times. But that thing that you describe, you know, positive is a funny word, isn't it? Because positive is like a plus sign, you know, more than in some way. Which I accept, it's a direction of travel, but definitely the experience for me as well is that something is revealed when you let something go.
Right.
You know, you don't necessarily have to use any muscles.
Yeah.
Even mental ones. Yeah. Yeah. And right at the beginning of my book, I talk about the experience that I had in Indonesia, and I won't go into it in all the detail, but essentially it was when I first heard my first Buddhist mentor speaking to just a small community group in one of the villages outside of Bandung in Indonesia. And he was speaking Indonesian, so I didn't even really understand what it was that he was saying. But he was talking in a very rhythmic, sort of calm way to these people who were, it was during the military rule period, you know, they were living very passive lives and just had food delivered to them once a week, which they were, you know, by the army, and they were very grateful for that. But that's basically how they lived, you know, between food parcels. And this was a visit by a group of young Buddhist anarchists, I call them, mostly young people, but led by this mentor. And he was giving a lecture to these people in the village. And, you know, what he was saying again and again was he would say something and then he'd puncture it with this word, ada, ada, right? And I didn't know what that meant and asked later on. But anyway, the upshot was that what he was basically saying was, you know, you feel as if there's nothing for you here, but there is. You feel as if you have no capacity to make change, but you do. You know, and it was this you feel as if there's no life in this place. Just look, it's there. You know, and this idea, ada, it's there, is something that I've really carried with me through my life and has helped me understand what it is that where what my source of what my source of creativity is. It, you know, it's basically that when you really think that you're up against a brick wall and you think there's nothing there, it's there, right? And so look again, or look with new eyes, or keep saying it's there to yourself until you can see it. Because it's really what you're doing is you're growing your capacity to see and think and feel. And if you couldn't see it before, if you believe that it's coming, it'll come, you know, and that's not necessarily, as you rightly say, that doesn't mean that you can turn black into white, but what you're really looking for is the, you know, the confirmation of life being present, and it's there, right? And it's there, and it's there. And you can keep you will be able to keep saying that as long as you're alive, and you'll feel the life, and that generates more life, right? It's not an answer; it's just the ongoing present. And so often, you know, when I'm with people who, you know, in these depressed, let's call them depressed communities, because that's how they're labeled by, you know, the political narrative. It's not necessarily money that they're looking for. It's energy and purpose and belief, and that can come out of nowhere. That can come simply through sharing.
It's the soil out of which creative, life affirming agency grows.
Yeah. And in the much bigger picture, you know, and now I'm talking to my peers, right? Us, you know, the people in the integral circles, you know, who I feel almost as if we're almost in a period right now where we're talking mostly about trauma and mostly about disconnectedness and demise, facing the truth of the state that we're in. But even here in our own circles, I often feel it's time for us to switch into the certainty that the answers, we have the answers within us. We have the possibilities within us. And let's move into that period, into that phase of knowing that it's there. You know, and I think I shared with you before, but it's a small example, is that so often when I'm in a room full of people, a Zoom room full of people, and we're talking about disconnect and the sadness and the difficulty of the disconnect, we really miss the miracle of our connectedness. That we're living in an age where we can talk to people across the whole planet. You know, people we've never met before switch into a Zoom room and share intimate stories about how we're feeling and be comforted by each other, who are simply strangers from the other side of the world. It's a miracle, actually, of connectedness. And I feel that we should acknowledge that and build on it and live in that space more with the certainty that we created that. And we wanted it, and we're in it. So now what?
For me, these last things that you've said, the whole way this last portion of our conversation has gone, has been a vivid manifestation of this declaration, Ada, it is there. And that invocation, it is present. It, you know, nothing is missing. This trust and active participation in the nonlinear, potentially miraculous nature of reality, which and that trusting relationship to it, is present here in this conversation. And I'm not sure I want to talk over that. Like, I almost feel as if we've reached close to a conclusion point. I kind of feel like maybe you have a little more to say that might restate this or summarize it in some way. I mean, I want to invite you to speak again, but I want to celebrate what has already occurred too. And not to veer away from it. It's so essential and bright.
Thank you. And I have the best conversations with you, Terry. And I'm not flattering you.
Well, I certainly love our conversations, Indra. It's been enlivening and delightful to spend this time. I'm glad we'll be able to share it with some others. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining Indra and me today. You can learn more about her work and her new book at Indra Adnan, IndraAdnan.global, and at thealternative.org.uk. thealternative.org.uk. And you'll also find links to her other important projects if you go to our website, stateofemergence.org, and click on this episode. We're curious, what's alive for you after listening? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Just send us an email at replies@newrepublicoftheheart.org with any question or reflection. And if you'd like to dive deeper into the ideas we explored together today, please join me and other listeners for our next live broadcast Q&A event. We meet every month to explore these conversations further. I'd love to see you there. Go to stateofemergence.org, click join the conversation, There you can register as a friend of State of Emergence by making a monthly contribution, and you'll get full access to all upcoming Q&A events. Thank you so much to all of you who have already done this and who are supporting us. If a few more join, we might be able to become sustainable financially. We're on the road, but have a ways to go. State of Emergence is made by Mason Ewald, Lou Judson, Kim Willis, Kristen Noth, David Chastain, Angela Murphy, Siobhan McClory, and Kimberly Kinzer. Music in this podcast was created by Asa Idoni. We are living together in a state of emergence.